Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You can earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply. The Moth Podcast is brought to you by Progressive, where drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. Quote now at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary.
Hey, y'all. This is Catherine Burns, the Moth's Artistic Director. I have exciting news. Our new book is about to be released. It's called Occasional Magic, True Stories About Facing the Impossible. It's got stories from some of our biggest names, but it's us. So you'll also hear stories from a 15-year-old saving a life in Chicago, a mother of triplets trekking to the North Pole, and a 90-year-old Russian man talking about his standoff with the KGB. The book is available for pre-order right now. If you love books, pre-ordering is important because it shows publishers what readers would love more of, what they're excited about. So if you love The Moth and books and stories, it would be a huge help to us if you consider pre-ordering. Thank you all for listening.
From PRX, this is The Moth Radio Hour. I'm Jennifer Hickson from The Moth, and I'll be your host this time. At The Moth, people of all kinds bring their stories to stages around the country and tell them in front of a live audience. This hour, we have four stories. You'll hear how 9/11 affected an Islamic NYU student, how a chain restaurant in Canada helped a depressed waiter, how a first grader attempted to salvage his academic status, and this first story from Carly Johnstone. The theme of the show was Stories from the Front. Carly first contacted us via the Moth pitch line. We liked what we heard, worked with her to develop the story, and then put her on stage in New York City. We'll tell you more about the pitch line later and how to pitch your own story, but for now, here's Carly Johnstone live at the Moth.
Okay. So in August of 1998, I was trying to give birth, and it was well attended. I had a nurse and two midwives, my boyfriend at the time, who was not the father, my foster brother, and two women who were also awaiting the birth of their first child, who also happened to be my child. 7 months prior to this, after many visits to the bathroom, glasses of water, and sticks peed upon, I had come to accept the fact that I was pregnant. And this was not the best of news for a bunch of reasons. One of them was that I was 16. More so than that, my life had been a lesson in negatives. It had been a lesson in what not to do. My mantra had been how not to be my mother. My mother was a prostitute. And I had grown up with her and many other prostitutes and the men that handle them. And when she died in the 80s, like so many from AIDS, I went into foster care. I did a year and a half there before my mother's parents, my grandparents, took me in under duress. And as you might note, people who don't want children probably shouldn't have them. And I went from being touched much too much in really painful and monstrous ways to never being touched at all. They lasted about 5 years with me before they threw in the towel, retired to Florida, and put me in a Southern Baptist children's home. And I lasted about a year and a half there before I thought I could do better than this. I could raise myself. I mean, the bar was pretty low. And I studied a lot, and I took a lot of tests, and I graduated high school 2.5 years early. And then I got on a Greyhound and went back to New Jersey, because that's where I grew up, and that's where I felt safe. And I started college at a local community college. I got my first full-time job, with full health benefits, and I got my first place. I was 16. And by the end of my 16th year, we get to the point with the bathroom and the pee sticks, and a wrench was thrown in the works. I knew a few things right off the bat. I wasn't going to abort. A lot of people asked me why I wasn't going to abort. A surprising amount of people were willing to ask, why don't you abort? And it wasn't because of some misbegotten belief in God or because I'm pro-life, because I'm not. It was because I really, really wanted this baby. I desperately wanted this baby. It was a pain. I always wanted a baby. I always wanted to be a mother. I always wanted a family. I always wanted something that was mine and pure and good and whole. And I wanted it, but I couldn't keep the promises I made to myself about having a family. That whole mantra about not being my mom. I couldn't give this kid a home. I couldn't give them a life without fear or want. I couldn't promise that I would be there all the time. I couldn't give unfailing support or provide a net. And so I had to find another solution. And I looked at traditional adoption, but I couldn't have a kid grow up the way I did, with so many questions about who you are and where you come from. And I looked at fostering, but again, you know, I had traveled that road. It hadn't really gone so well. And finally, someone explained open adoption. And if you don't understand what it is, it means that the adoptive parents want an ongoing relationship with the mother. And the mother, she gets to choose the parents. And I thought, I can do this. If he never has questions, if he always knows where he comes from, I can do that. And so I attacked this like I attacked everything else in my life, like a research paper. And I made a lot of calls and made a lot of notes, and I finally found an agency that could meet my criteria, and I had three. My first was that it was a same-sex couple, because at this time it was a little harder for them to adopt. But additionally, despite my own sexual ambiguity, I realized that if I ever settled down, if I ever found anyone to settle down with, it would be another woman. I never wanted that to be an issue. Number two, they had to not have any extreme religious affiliation. I had had religion shoved down my throat, and I thought faith should be a choice and something questioned. And number three, they had to want an interracial child as their first choice. This father, the father of this baby, was black, and I was half very white and half something very brown and short. And so I wanted this kid to be a first choice. I didn't want it to be something they settled upon because they couldn't find a perfect blonde-haired, blue-eyed baby, or because they were trying to better their karma. And even with those narrow parameters, I had over 200 couples that were viable choices, and each of them had a brochure. And each brochure was full of pictures of their family and friends and their homes, and how well-educated they were, and how much support they had, and how financially stable they were. And so if you're ever thinking of adopting, I recommend a history in marketing. And after going through those, I found about 40 or 50 couples that I really liked, and I made a long list of questions. And some of them are what you might expect, like, why are you adopting? But a lot of them were a little different, like, how are you going to do this kid's hair? And why don't you believe in God? And what do you do when you're mad? And eventually, I found a couple that I really liked. Their names are Gwen and Gretchen. I did not pick their names, but it's really fucking cute. And they lived up in Portland, Maine, which was far enough for me because I didn't want them to be too close because I totally knew I might be a stalker mom and I didn't want to like find myself on a playground. So they were like far enough away that I could get there if I needed to, but also far enough away that I couldn't like run there in 10 minutes. And they came down from Maine to meet me. And Gretchen is tall and strong and unflappable, and Gwynnie is tiny and sweet and nurturing. and I liked them. And they liked me, which was really important because they had to deal with me for a really long time. And a lot of people had not really hung in there. So, but I knew they were right. I knew that they would work. And they, I chose them. And they gave me an 800 number so I could always reach them. And we waited the wait of expectant parents. And it got bigger, and eventually we find ourselves back in this delivery room. And after 23 hours of back labor, I gave birth to an 8-pound, 6-ounce baby boy. And he was perfect. And he was whole. And he was so beautiful. And he had all of his fingers and toes. And I had 48 hours with him, and I sang him every song I knew. And I tried to say hello to him, and I tried to say goodbye to him. And at the end of that 24 hours, I brought him downstairs, and I helped them strap him into a car seat, and I watched these strangers walk away with my baby. And I hoped I had made the right choice. I hoped they were the right people. I hoped he would forgive me. And I never cried. And when I went home, I finally did. I shattered. I broke into a million pieces. And I looked at my body, this 17-year-old body that should be healthy and strong and young. And it was broken too. I had stretch marks that looked like purple claws had come from my belly button to my pubis. And my stomach, that had so recently been filled with life, was flaccid and dead. And my breasts were heavy and hard and swollen and leaking, trying to feed a child that wasn't there, a baby that was gone. And I didn't know what to do. And I had such a good start, but I stopped living the mantra of how not to be my mother, and I did my best to prove I was just as bad as her. I was someone that could give away a baby. I was the person that could throw away a child. And after never drinking and never smoking and never doing anything bad, that's all I did for the next 3 or 4 years, was just try to destroy myself as quickly as possible. And after 4 years, I made my way to Maine. I finally got up the courage to visit this family that had my child. And I went to their home, and it was beautiful. And everyone in it was the kind of person that did what they said they were going to do as a child. They're actors and inventors and dancers. And the kitchen is the kind of place where everyone goes to tell their story, and friends meet. And all I saw was everything I wasn't. All I saw was a bar I would never meet. And I watched these people raise a child that I was incapable of holding or touching or saying I loved you, and I didn't know how to do that. I didn't know how to do it for myself. I didn't know how to do it for them. I just hadn't been given those tools in my life. But I did realize on that trip that I had to get my shit together. I had to be someone eventually that this kid, when he was old enough to ask the questions, I had to be someone worth asking those questions to. And so I went home and I stopped doing all of those horrible things to myself, slowly, over years. And I made better friends and started building my own family. And eventually I got better, and every year in August I would visit them, and every year it was a little easier to talk and it was a little easier to share. And it wasn't so horrible when everyone stared at me and said, "You look just like him." And when he was turning 9, I realized I really needed to change. And I was invited to a meditation seminar about an hour north of Portland. And I went with 2 of my best friends, and we were given homework. We were asked to bring something we needed to get rid of, and I had a lot to get rid of. But the one thing I had to get rid of was this concept, this idea about myself, this comparison, this idea that I was Henry's mother, because that's his name, Henry. Because I wasn't. There's a big difference between the person that gives birth to you and the people that raise you. I knew that from my own life. It just took me a long time to learn that lesson for myself. And after this shedding and meditation, we went to Portland. It was the first time I brought friends with me. It was the first time I didn't second guess myself every time I spoke to them. It was the first time I didn't stop myself from touching him. And I realized this meditation hadn't changed me as a human being. It had just changed my perception. My perception in this comparison, it had changed how I saw them, because I realized these people, these wonderful, amazing people who did such an amazing job raising this brilliant kid, had given me the only blueprint I had. They gave me the foundation for what a family should be, and what love was, and loyalty, and what a mother could be, what two moms could be. And I left there, and it was the first time I did not cry all the way till Boston and scream until New Jersey. And I got home, and the year he was turning 10, I found out I was pregnant again. But this time it was so much different, because I had spent these years trying to build a real family. And the people in my life were so excited because this baby was the first in our family. And I was still poor, and I was still uneducated, but I wasn't alone. I had this wonderful family, and they called, and they wrote, and they put ads on Craigslist, and they drove all over the tri-state area, and they filled a storage space with so many baby things that I had to give away two of many things. And when she was born, this birth was also well attended. So many people were there, they had to turn people away at the maternity ward. And Henry carries a picture of Asha in his wallet. I named her Asha. It means hope in Sanskrit. And it was so different. And this year, in April, when she turned 4, and my son will be 14 this year, he came with his mother, Gretchen, to our house and shared our home and stayed with our family and all the people that chose to be there. And I watched him hold her and play with her. I watched them as part of my family for the first time, really realizing that they were part of me too. And I watched this beautiful, brilliant, strong boy carry his beautiful, brilliant little sister and realize he had become part of the net that would hold her up. Thank you.
That was Carly Johnstone. The night she told the story, everyone you just heard about was in attendance. Gwenny, Gretchen, and Henry all came down from Maine to see the show, and Carly's 4-year-old daughter, Asha, came to the venue early for a visit, since showtime was also her bedtime. When they all came up to embrace her after the show, they really did look like one big happy family. Carly's story is included in our book, The Moth, 50 True Stories, published by Hyperion. When I asked her to choose a title, she decided it should be A Perfect Circle. To see a picture of Carly with Henry and Asha, visit our Radio Extras page at themoth.org. Carly came to us through our pitch line. If you have a story, we'd love to hear it. Record it right on our site, themoth.org, or call 877-799-MOTH. That's 877-799-6684. The best pitches are developed for Moth shows all around the country. In a moment, we'll hear one story that takes place during a single dinner shift at the Macaroni Grill, and another during a single day in the life of a first grader.
The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
Support for The Moth comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so that you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything. CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it, Odoo's got it.
To learn more, visit odoo.com/moth. That's odoo.com/moth.
Our next two stories are from our beloved open mic series, The Moth Story Slam, where we provide the stage, a host, a theme, and the general public brings us the five-minute stories. The shows happen on a monthly, sometimes weekly basis in cities across the country. You can check our website to see if there are any near you. This next story is from Sam S. Mullins. He's from Canada, but came to New York City for his birthday one August, just in time for a story slam. Luckily, his name was picked from the hat. Here's Sam.
So I was sitting in my apartment one night, and I was thinking about the button on the elevator that gives me access to the roof, because I was thinking about killing myself, which is terrifying for me to think about now. But in the moment, it wasn't hard for me to think about. It was like soothing to think about. And I was in like a really shit time in my life, like breakup shit job. I was living in the city, and it just completely crushed my soul. And that night, I ended up passing out on the floor in my kitchen. Fine. And then, the very next night, it happened. It was just like any other night for me, waiting tables at the Macaroni Grill in downtown Vancouver. I was inches away from a full-blown anxiety attack. The chef was livid with me because one of my tables didn't think his medium rares were medium rare enough. And I was so dehydrated that when I went to pee, it came out as a paste. I'm like, that is not pee. I was like just barely hanging on my section, just sprinting around when I'm set at a table of four. So I go up to the table with water glasses to greet them. And something about these people immediately put me at ease. They just seem like really calm and present and just like good people. And right away, it was like two parents and two grown-up kids about my age. And right away, the father shook my hand. He's like, "What's your name?" I'm like, "Sam." He's like, "You look like a Sam." And we started talking and having banter, and they were really into the fact that I was a struggling / failed actor and writer. And they kind of became my number one priority, and they were my oasis in the mayhem. And they really knew how to dine. Like, they had a lot of nice appetizers and fine wines. I cleared all that away, and I got them set up for entrees. And I went and I picked up their food, and I came out to the table, and I sat their food down, and then I paused, and I asked them the question that the Macaroni Grill trained me to ask. I said, "Is there anything else that I can get for you?" And then, without skipping a beat, the father looks me in the eye and says, "Yes, a tinfoil dinosaur, please." And before I could say what, his daughter looks at me with a twinkle in her eye and she's like, "Yes, a tinfoil dinosaur would be perfect." And that kind of made that sound that we all make when life doesn't make sense. And I kind of brushed it off. I'm like, "Okay, enjoy. And I'm like, I guess I should clarify. Is there any particular type of dinosaur that you would prefer?" And again, without skipping a beat, "A Tyrannosaurus Rex, please." Very well. So I go over to the server station. I'm like, wait, they like a literal tinfoil dinosaur? But then I remembered, oh, I know what just happened. This is like the time that someone ordered a brown cow and I didn't know what they were talking about. They just ordered a fancy drink that I've never heard of. So I go over to the bartender and he's like making his drinks and he senses me lurking. He's like, "What can I get for you, Sam?" I'm like, "Doug, do the words tinfoil dinosaur mean anything to you?" He's like, "I have no idea what you're talking about." I'm like, "Okay." So this confirmed to me that we were indeed talking about a literal tinfoil dinosaur. So I guess I need some tinfoil. So I go in the kitchen and I tore off a 7-foot piece of tinfoil and I started sculpting. And I'm not noted for my artistic virtuosity, but this dinosaur, you guys, was my Sistine Chapel. It stood It stood 2 feet tall, and it had like an angular head and a sloping tail and two big bulky legs and the T-Rex talon arms. And while I'm making it, all of my coworkers are gathered around silently like they're watching this great thing take place. So I put it under my arm, and I go and I tore off a second piece of tinfoil, 7 feet long. And I took that out of the kitchen, out into the dining room, and I took the dinosaur and I planted it in the center of their table like it was the flag of my country. And their jaws hit the floor. They couldn't believe what I'd just done. And then the father pointed to the other piece of tinfoil I had. He's like, "What's that piece of tinfoil for?" And this time, I was deadpan. "I challenge you." So then he started making a dinosaur too, and the restaurant was totally abuzz. There were like people leaving their half-eaten dinners, and all the cooks stopped cooking, and everyone was gathered around for the world's first tinfoil dinosaur sculpting competition. It was completely ridiculous, but it was kind of magic. Like there was like electricity in the air, you know. And later on, they were the last table to leave the restaurant that night, and all four of them came up and gave me a hug, and the father said, "Sam, you went above and beyond. Thank you." And I'll always remember the silhouette of him walking out into the night with a tinfoil dinosaur under each arm. I like to think that they still live on their dining room table. And I remember walking home that night, and I felt really happy for the first time in a long time. Thank you.
That was Sam S. Mullins, live at the Moth Story Slam on his 26th birthday. Sam lives in Vancouver, Canada, where he tells lots of stories, often on the CBC show Definitely Not the Opera. You can find a link to his website at themoth.org. Our next story comes from Steve Zimmer. He's a Moth regular who's won dozens of story slams and a few grand slams to boot. Here's Steve live at a Moth Story Slam.
"1969, first grade, room 6. In honor of the space program, our child-hating teacher, Miss Ross, divides the class into three groups based on ability: stars, rockets, and moons. Even though I'm a moon, I quickly deduce which is the dumb group. But for added clarity, they give our classes different names. Stars and rockets have math. We have numerics. And even among the moons, I'm a bad moon. My report card says that I don't apply myself as a student, but it also questions my potential in case I do try. Now, my mom and dad don't apply themselves as parents, but even if they did, there's no way they could know I have severe ADD because it doesn't exist yet, especially the quiet kind. Now, one morning in class, I noticed that all the other students each have 5 different species of leaves. I assume it's a coincidence, but then I look up at the nearest star, Kathy Wilt, and see her yellow folder with a smiling leaf and the words Leaf Day. And I'm like, I don't know it yet, but this moment will repeat itself in various forms throughout my life. So I get bathroom permission and go outside to pick leaves, which turns out to be really interesting. You know, I could stay out there for hours, but there's two things I don't know. One, I'm picking leaves right outside our classroom window. And two, Miss Ross has been building a case to get me transferred to Rugen Elementary for their special ed program. So on the way back to class, I stop off in the bathroom, very important, because I'd ask permission, so I have to go, otherwise I'm a liar. And so I put my leaves under the bathroom garbage can to smooth them out. And I've got the bathroom all to myself, so I get a stool, and I put liquid soap on paper towels and soak them in water, and that's how I make my own moist towelettes. But my work gets interrupted by the appearance of a group of fourth grade raptors. So I grab all my stuff and zip back to class. Back in room 5, Ms. Ross casually inquires as to what I've been doing with myself for the last hour. And I say, I was in the bathroom. And she says, were you outside? And I don't want to answer her, but I know from TV it's worse if you run. So she's like, I saw you outside. And so I'm like, yeah, but I went to the bathroom too. And she says, do you know what deception is? And I'm like, no, which is true, I don't. Hello, I'm a moon. And so Ms. Ross then makes me empty my conspicuously stuffed pockets, and I hand over several plastic baggies of moist towelettes, but no leaves because I forgot them in the bathroom. So I'm clean, except for deception. And nonetheless, Ms. Ross sends me to the principal's office where I have, like, an endowed chair. And but I actually like it there with, you know, the compassionate secretary and the Highlights magazines. And most importantly, the quiet. I'm intimidated by the other kids and how wild they are. And that's the weird thing. Ms. Ross sees it like she's order and I'm chaos. But I'm actually like her. I try hard to follow the rules, and I stress out if the other kids don't follow the rules. In fact, I still do. And so eventually an eighth grade lunch girl comes in and takes me back to class. But on the way back, she lets me stop in the bathroom, where I'm able to sneak out my leaves. And so back in class, Ms. Ross is collecting her leaf packets. So I fold my leaves into a piece of notebook paper. Book paper and draw a picture of a smiling leaf amoeba on front. Not great, but I figure I should at least beat this one kid who I'm pretty sure got all his leaves from the same tree. And he's a rocket. So I assume Ms. Ross will accept my assignment because I'd met the rules. And I don't know at this point how people really are. It never occurs to me that she might flunk me just because I deserve it in the big picture, or because I must have cheated somewhere, or because of towelettes. The next day, we get back our papers, our packets. Mine has a big red C-. It's my best grade of the year, and it revs me up to excel in school, which I don't, but I do well enough to pass two of the disruptive kids and avoid Rugen Elementary. In 1969, you checked into special ed, but you didn't check out. Especially if you were already prone to downward spirals. And if Ms. Ross hadn't respected the rules, I might not have finished high school. I probably wouldn't have finished college. And I definitely would not have gotten a PhD in math. Or thank you. Or as some of us call it, numerics.
That was Steve Zimmer. Side note, Steve's PhD in economics, Harvard University. And proof that old labels die hard, the night Steve told this story in Chicago, two of his old friends from elementary school attended. Later, they said that they couldn't remember who was stars or rockets, but that they definitely remembered all of the moons. When we come back, we'll hear a story from a chaplain in the New York City Police Department.
The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
This is the Moth Radio Hour from PRX. I'm Jennifer Hickson from The Moth. Our last story is from Imam Khalid Latif. He told it for a show in Seattle called Prejudice and Power. Here's Khalid Latif live at the Moth.
So So when I was about 12 years old, my brother and I went to Pakistan to visit my grandmother after my grandfather had passed away. And at 12 years of age, I looked a lot different from what I look like right now. We were walking down the street, and I was wearing my Timberland boots. I had on some baggy jeans. I had really long Pantene Pro-V kind of hair. I was wearing a white baseball hat backwards. I definitely didn't look like I belonged there. And as we were going down the street, we came upon a young boy. He was probably about 6 years of age. He was wearing a more cultural attire, what we call a shalwar kameez. It was like a mint green tea colored kind of thing. And he started to look me up and down. And when we got closer, he definitely let me know that I didn't belong where I was. He craned his head backwards and screamed on the top of his lungs to everybody who was listening to him, "Get Michael Jackson aage, that Michael Jackson is here." And then he and his friends started to chase me up and down the street because they thought I was Michael Jackson. And I'm definitely not Michael Jackson. And now 15 years later, when I think back to that time, it definitely makes me laugh, but it also makes me think a little bit. This kid, the way that he saw me dressed, the way that he kind of understood me to be, was something that one could say maybe was his idea of an American, but it was definitely his idea of something that was not Pakistani. And for me, if I didn't fit in there in the country where my parents came from, and it was really difficult for me to figure out how to fit in here where I was born, I didn't really know where I belonged. Where was I supposed to go? Now, when I was entering into my freshman year at New York University, I really didn't have any intention of being part of any kind of organized Islamic activity, which sounds pretty bad when you say it like that. And so, for whatever reason, I went and sought out the Muslim Student Organization, thinking that the kind of people I would meet would be like people I grew up with who were Muslim. My dad, he's a doctor, he was from Pakistan. Most of the Muslims we interacted with growing up happened to be doctors and their families who were Pakistani. And when I went to this student organization's meeting at NYU, I was pretty astonished because the first Muslim that I met was not somebody who was South Asian like me, but he was Indonesian, he had a scraggly beard, he was carrying a surfboard in his hand, and it was just really strange for me to conceptualize, especially because we were in Manhattan and he was carrying a surfboard in his hand. But I had never met a Muslim who was Indonesian before. Now when I walked into the room where the meeting was taking place, I saw Muslims who were definitely Arab and Muslims who were South Asian, but also saw Muslims who were black, Muslims who were white. I even saw a lot of people who weren't Muslim. And for the first time, I got to actually see really how deep and diverse the religion of Islam can actually be. In that year, my religious identity, or the component of my identity that was aligned to my religion, it began to cement itself a little bit stronger. It began to externally manifest itself a little bit. I grew out my beard. I started to cover my head. And the way I started to look was a little bit more stereotypically the way a Muslim would look. Now, when I was going into my sophomore year, I was running through Washington Square Park, which is in the middle of NYU's campus, a little bit late for my Arabic class. I had overslept like I usually do on my way to classes in the morning. And when I walked into the classroom, my professor wasn't really teaching, and all the students were talking to one another, and I had no idea what was going on. A few minutes after I got there, a security guard came to the door, and he said, "Everybody, please get all your belongings. Make sure to not leave anything here. We need to evacuate the building. A plane has flown into the World Trade Center." I then left from the building with my classmates, and we went back into Washington Square Park, which just a few moments before had been completely empty, and now there was probably about 10 or 12,000 kids standing in the park. And everybody was looking downtown towards where the World Trade Center was. Everyone was speaking to one another, there was a lot of commotion, and as we stood there, we were suddenly struck by this really awesome silence because a second plane then flew into the building. What felt like an eternity, but was actually moments, soon just passed by, and as instantaneous as the silence came about, it was shattered and people started to run everywhere. I went into my dormitory and I started to hear conversations of people who were living in my building who didn't know that I was within earshot, and they were saying things to the effect of, we need to get all the Muslims together and send them out of this country because they're all violent and they're all terrorists. And when they saw that I was there and I could hear what they were saying, they got really quiet. And I said to them, you shouldn't stop on my account. If you actually believe it and you mean it, you should keep going. My two roommates at that time were two of my friends who were Hindu, and they wouldn't let me walk around by myself. There was a young woman who lived in my building who actually tried to push me down the staircase. It was a really, really tough situation. My parents, they were feeling it very hard because they lived in New Jersey and they had no way of knowing if I was okay. And even worse, they had no way of getting me out of New York. When I was finally able to get out of the city, I got on a train, I took it to Edison where I grew up. And as I was going into the parking lot of the train station, my sister ran out of the car and she hugged me in front of everybody in the parking lot with tears running down her face because she was so worried at what could have possibly happened to me or what she thought could have potentially happened to me had I not gotten out of New York. We got back home and my father sat me down and he said that when you go back to New York, I would prefer if you didn't cover your head anymore. My father, he's a pretty religious guy from certain standards. He's got a big white beard. He himself covers his head. He started to do it after my brother had started doing it when he went for his undergrad when he was about 18. He kind of looks like one of the seven dwarves, if you want to conceptualize it. Right? When I was in high school, a girl gave me a really giant sleepy dwarf, and it looks just like my dad. So now this man who looks like Sleepy is sitting me down in our living room, and he's saying to me, don't cover your head. And it was a real challenging kind of thought for me to synthesize and make critical sense of, because over the last year, I hadn't gone out into the world not looking like a Muslim. And my parents, they were always encouraging me and pushing me to do some of these things. And now they were sitting down at a time when people had questions about Islam and they wanted to know what the religion actually stood for. They were telling me, we would feel a little bit more comfortable if you just kind of blended in and didn't let people know that you were a Muslim. And so since my father was asking me, I did what he told me to do. Classes started again. I went back to NYU. And I walked into my Arabic class, and I saw that a lot of my classmates, they had tried to blend in as well. Girls who wore headscarves were now wearing hoodie sweatshirts. Some of them were wearing turtlenecks and had wrapped bandanas around their heads. A lot of guys who had very long beards had trimmed their beards down. Some had even completely shaven them off. Everyone was trying to just, quote-unquote, fit in. And then there was one young woman who, prior to the 9/11 attacks, she was wearing a headscarf to cover her hair, but under her own volition, she also chose to wear a face veil so that all you could see of her face were her eyes. And now, post 9/11, she had made a decision to still wear her headscarf, but she took off her face veil because she was worried what might happen if somebody saw her dressed like that. And for the first time, I was able to look into this girl's face, and she looked back into my face, and I really felt so wretched. That here I was hiding who I am and blending in, and this young woman alone was there representing my faith and my tradition to everyone who wanted an answer as to why what had just happened a couple of weeks before had actually happened. And I was letting her do it by herself. And so I made a decision that I would no longer hide who I am. That I would make a point to not just play the part, but also look the part to the best of my ability. And that if somebody had a question that they wanted answered, I would take full responsibility of telling my story and my narrative and not letting somebody else define for others what I actually am. These days, I work as a university chaplain at New York University. I also work as a chaplain for the New York City Police Department, and I'm regularly invited to gatherings like this, to the media, to do interviews, where I answer questions about Islam, and I try to deconstruct a lot of the negative stereotypes that people associate with my tradition. And more often than not, the response that I get is one that's very welcoming, but there's still instances that definitely highlight to me the need to go out and still engage and educate. This past September, I stood with the families of individuals who had passed away on 9/11 some 10 years ago now. And I've been doing this in my role as a New York City Police Department chaplain since I started working with the NYPD. The way it kind of works, we have breakfast with the families, we get in buses, and we go down to a special area that's reserved for these families near the stage and near the Ground Zero site. And during the day, in its entirety, I'm wearing my police uniform. It's an inspector uniform. But at the same time, I still have my beard, and I'm still wearing my cap. And so this past September, when I'm standing with these families, I was approached by three individuals who were wearing suits who asked me to show them my police credentials to just ensure that I actually worked for the NYPD. They said that Secret Service spotted you from the top of a building, and they asked us to come and ask you just in case. Just in case. And I said to him, just in case what? And the one guy said, I'm really sorry that we're doing this to you. And I said to him, then why are you doing it? And there was a woman who was standing next to me whose son had passed away on September 11th in 2001. And she said to me, I'm sorry that they're doing this to you also. That what they're doing to you right now is more dishonoring of the memory of my son who I lost on that day, and the fact that you as a Muslim are able to stand with us here and remember those who we lost is not just an act of compassion, but it's an act of courage as well. And we most definitely appreciate the fact that you are willing to stand with us in our moment of need. And so for me, it gave me a sense of promise and a sense of hope that as much as there were still people who were only willing to look at what they stereotyped me to be, at what they preconceived me to be, and understand me in that way, and tell me that I don't have a place to be here and I need to be somewhere else, there were still individuals who were willing to say to me that I most definitely belong here, and this place where I was born is some place that I should always be able to stay. Thank you.
That was Imam Khalid Latif. He serves as executive director and chaplain of the Islamic Center at NYU. To see a short profile of Khalid Latif in his role at the NYPD, visit our Radio Extras page at themoth.org. You can pitch us your story at themoth.org. Record it right on our site or call 877-799-MOTH. That's 877-799-6684. Here's a pitch we like.
Hi, my name's Jeremy. Story I'd like to tell you has to do with my mother. I'm an emergency physician, and she, about 6 months ago, got diagnosed with lung cancer. The real short version, she had a port placed in her chest, which in front of me, I caused her lung to collapse. In the series of having a couple of anxiety attacks and other things that she'd gone through that day, she began to go into cardiovascular collapse right in front of my face. My story involves basically getting her into the ER real quickly, and as she's going under with sedation and anesthesia, going through the process of deciding whether or not we should even try to bring her back from this. But I do think it's a compelling story about, for me at least, being incredibly powerful being incredibly powerless and standing by somebody who stood by me their whole life. Anyway, she's still alive and doing fine.
Remember, you can pitch us your story at themoth.org. You can find all of the stories you heard in this hour at the iTunes Store. Don't forget to check our website for upcoming main stage shows or story slams in your area. And thanks so much for listening. We hope you'll join us next time for the Moth Radio Hour.
Your host this hour was Jennifer Hickson. Jennifer also directed the stories in the show.
So if you have your name in the hat and you didn't get to tell the story, we're going to read those names off, and it'd be great if you would come up and just tell us your first name and the first line of your story.
The rest of the Moth's directorial staff includes Catherine Burns, Sarah Haberman, Sarah Austin Jeunesse, and Meg Bowles, with production support from Jenna Weiss-Berman and Brandon Ector.
Hi, my name's Neil. My dad is a gynecologist who owns a liquor store.
Moth events are recorded by Argo Studios in New York City, supervised by Paul Ruest. Our theme music is by The Drift. Other music in this hour from Bill Frisell, the Chandler Travis Trio, Bart Howard, Keith Jarrett, and Floratone. The Pitchline story came from Jeremy Orvik.
I was told that the initiation for the cross-country team involved duct tape, shaving cream, and a portable toilet.
The Moth is produced for radio by me, Jay Allison, at Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, with help from Vicki Merrick.
There was clear within 6 minutes there would be no second date.
This hour was produced with funds from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world.
I'm not a very brave person. I can't handle confrontation, and it takes the jaws of life for me to take any action. Therefore, it was really out of character and beyond my comfort zone for me to jump into the arena in San Sebastian, Spain, and fight that bull.
The Moth Radio Hour is presented by the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org. For more about our podcast, for information on pitching your own story, and everything else, go to our website, themoth.org. Reminder that The Moth's new book is available. It features 50 amazing true stories from our archive, with many of our all-time favorites here on The Moth Radio Hour.
Well, there you go. Hope you enjoyed the show. That was The Moth Radio Hour right here on the podcast. I think we laughed, we cried, we had basically just about every emotion. And now, basically, I think I'll smother all of my feelings with holiday leftovers. This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. To try Audible free today and get a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/themoth. And here's another thing. The Moth Main Stage is returning to the Paramount Theater in Austin on Wednesday, December 11th. For tickets and for a list of all of our upcoming tour stops, visit themoth.org.
Our podcast host, Dan Kennedy, is a writer and performer living in New York and author of the new novel, American Spirit. Available now.
Thanks to all of you for listening, and we hope you have a story-worthy week. Podcast audio production by Paul Ruest at the Argo Studios in New York. The Moth Podcast and the Radio Hour are presented by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, helping make public radio more public at PRX.org.